your ordinary paper. We'll now start with part two, broadcast 651. It's May 28th, 1984. There is a story in the San Jose Mercury and the Washington Post, a small one on the Korean airline, KL007. This is the way it reads. The judge limits the court's power. Remember, I was glad that people were to sue the government on the Korean airline story so they could get some more information about the air flights. Well, a federal judge, Judge Aubrey E. Robinson, Jr., acting in a suit arising from the Soviet downing of a South Korean airline, ruled yesterday, now listen to this, that the courts have no authority to act on political questions about decisions made by the United States Armed Forces. Now, listen to that again. That means that the military, like Nazi Germany, the courts that were perverted, that I mentioned many times over and over, the government, the legal civilian government, can't act if the U.S. Army is involved. The U.S. is protected. Now, remember the story of Leslie Howard, the actor who was on an airplane, and they knew the Nazis were going to destroy the plane, but they didn't save the plane or the passengers because then the Germans would know that we were piped into their intelligence system, and for the greater good, they sacrificed 100 or more people so that they could protect more people and listen to the conversations of the Germans. If they had picked up the other, then the Germans would have used a different means of communication. Now, that has an excuse that was passable then, and I didn't study the case then, so I don't know enough about it. But in this particular case, the interesting thing about this case is that you have a congressman, a right-wing congressman, where there's committees against the Korean committee, against the Soviet Union, where the media had their scripts written, their stories written. It was like going to World War III. It was a cause celebre. The martyr of the Birch Society, shot down by the communists when he tells you communism is so bad. It is a political act that can get you into war, like the Reichstag fire was excuse for rounding up well-meaning people who weren't communists and putting them in the camps and getting them killed and out of the way. So when you know that a plane is going off course for some reason, and they knew it was going off course, they didn't warn them because they're not obligated to warn them, but they can use the benefit of martyring the man for the political purposes, for getting more missiles, for deploying missiles along the coast in Europe, for putting weapons up in the Arctic, in the Pacific. It is an excuse to have another $45 billion budget or $2 billion submarine in the Pacific because of the Korean airline. So the excuse of not letting the people know on the plane that they are going over the Soviet Union is so limp in this case because the act became political. I'll read this one more time. The judge said regarding the suit, he threw it out, the courts, his court, who knows who Judge Robinson is? The courts have no authority to act on political questions on decisions that are made by the U.S. Armed Forces. The armed forces precede the courts. He made his decision to dismiss a lot of lawsuits against the federal government coming out of the Korean airline flight September the 1st over the Sea of Japan. He said the relatives of the victims may look at government files and uncover, if they want, the existence of whether there was a legal duty to warn or advise civilian aircraft if they were in a position that was dangerous. They can look that up. But there were 81 lawsuits filed by families of 240 passengers, and these have been thrown out because the civilian courts can't come in and question the United States Armed Forces decision, but the armed forces can tell you we need hundreds of millions of dollars, whereas they might have prevented the flight by telling him to come back and slow down the arms weapon escalation that they don't have the money to pay for anyway. Now, regarding the Grenada trials, remember those took place, the killing of Maurice Bishop, and seven people were rounded up, for a trial down there in Grenada. This happened last October. It's about 8 months since then. San Francisco Examiner, hearing put off in Grenada killings. The judge has postponed again a preliminary hearing until June on the slaying of Prime Minister Maurice Bishop and seven supporters of his last October that led to the invasion of the Caribbean island. The judge has set a new date because 14 of the 20 defendants don't have a lawyer yet. This is from October until it's almost June. There's no lawyer for 14 people. And the defendants are saying that America is there illegally, that they resulted, the U.S. invasion led to an illegal operation, and that the government can't try them because it's an illegitimate government. The United States had no business coming in, and they said this should be taken to the international courts, and the people that killed Maurice Bishop and the other person say, you have no right even, we don't have a lawyer, but you have no right to be here. So scram. So I think they don't want the trial because the people that killed Maurice Bishop funded Bernard Cord. This was the CIA and Robert Vesco and his CIA contacts, even though he's living in Cuba. The CIA was involved heavily down there in those deaths. So they have a contradiction. They can't convict the people they hired to kill Maurice Bishop and his seven friends. So they don't want to go to trial. They won't accept the American court. It's a catch-22. We hired them and paid them, and they were working in collusion with the medical school there. After Maurice Bishop was killed, they were in contact with the American officials, Robert Pastor and Dr. Peter Byrne. So they say, look, get an international court because we use them to allow us to go down there to start tourism and to clean out the people that were there and to use the airstrip. Today there's an article where I have a new American company to put in the airstrip down there that we wanted all along that was started by Maurice Bishop. And the defendants have no attorney. And, of course, we're afraid to go to trial, so they're stalling out. There was another death I thought I should bring up. I haven't gone into some of these miscellaneous deaths, but I think they're interesting. Top space mission engineer and two others die in a plane crash. The chief engineer from McDonnell Corporation, who was in charge of the Mercury and Gemini space missions, went into a 24-inch oak tree and had a little plane accident outside of Ukiah, California. He crashed into an oak tree. One of the main scientists for the space program. In the early 1960s, Mr. Walter F. Burke was in charge of McDonnell Corporation, responsible for building the Mercury and Gemini spacecraft. McDonnell Douglas Corporation spokesman said Burke, who retired in 1973, was the father of the company's space program, and he ends his life with a 24-inch oak tree. What if it was a 30-inch oak tree? But such details, he didn't fly well. He could send us up to the space program and design all that, but he goes into a 24-inch oak tree. Another fatal crash that many of you read about, this was in a lot of papers, but the implications weren't discussed. That was Lieutenant General Robert Bond, like James Bond, outside of Las Vegas. He was flying from Nellis Air Force Base in a secret area, top secret area number 51, over 10 years ago. That's where the U-2 flights were tested and worked out, the ones that went over the Soviet Union and conveniently downed to break up the peace conference of Khrushchev and Eisenhower at the time. He was using a top experimental plane that first they said was the stealth plane, and then it turned out that the fatal crash was the Soviet MiG, the MiG, Soviet MiG Flogger supersonic fighter. Now, what's important about this, the plane comes from the Mideast in Israel, and we send over Soviet weapons and test them here. The problem is that we're always told that war or dropping of bombs or provocations will come from kamikaze. But how many Soviet-marked planes could circle an American plane, say like the Larry McDonald, or out at sea, or circle a ship? And our American ships have said that the Soviet circles will shoot them. How many Soviet planes, just like Soviet guns, are bought by Samuel Cummings and the gun merchants of the world and then distributed? And if somebody is killed, they say the KGB was here. How many Soviet planes can be used as a provocation that have the markings and gear
See, the change of costume, the change of equipment was what Otto Skorzeny did so brilliantly for Adolf Hitler and then for our CIA. He got people in Germany in 1943 when the Nazis were going under, rounded them up and had them learn to smoke cigarettes like Americans, talk English, use American habits. He got American Army uniforms that he was never prosecuted for, American tanks that were never explained, went into the Battle of the Bulge as if they were Americans, and the Americans were fooled, and then they took off their clothes, and they were part of Hitler's elite guard, the Waffen-SS, and so forth. Skorzeny was released from prison along with these other criminals and then went to Madrid to work for the Central Intelligence Agency and set up the Odessa around the world. But the change of costumes or the change of equipment was very important. But in this case, this can be used again, like the Korean airline, to get you closer to World War III, that you positively see a Soviet plane. Now, if we're flying so many of those Soviet planes, how would you know whether it was a Soviet or whether it was an American in a Soviet suit that's down and we could say they bombed one of our ships? Therefore, give us 60 billion more weapons, more satellites, see, put your atomic warheads in Europe. Look what the Soviets do. Mr. James Bond, flying the plane, was caught. He died. And how he crashed, how many others are there like him? He was one of our best pilots, one of the most experienced, and Lieutenant General Robert Bond, and he was a victim caught in the Soviet plane. The Daily World has a story about a Chicago labor leader who was killed. There was an inquiry into his death. The Commission for Justice for Rudy Lozano, L-O-Z-A-N-O, he helped people who had escaped from El Salvador. He lived in Cook County. He was getting death threats. He helped labor union and organizers in the International Garment Workers Union. He helped people who had the lowest wages in the entire United States with their living conditions, how they, and when they were defrauded, he was helping them. And he, as I say, in Cook County, he was getting deaths. They rounded up an 18-year-old kid and had a trial, and they said he's the one who killed Lozano, and then they had a mistrial and want to have a dismissal of the entire murder charge. They charged a guy named Gregory Escobar, accused of killing him, literally a teenager such as those in El Salvador. And the way you close a case, you know, you can have the finest techniques with laboratories, with fingerprints, scientific techniques. You see all this stuff on the news, the TV, how the crime bureau has budget for these wonderful ways to solve crimes. But this is the way they solve a crime. You turn a pocket inside out and you call it a robbery, and you drop white powder and you call it a drug death. And you don't need any more equipment. If it's a political person, if it's a labor organizer, if it's a artist or writer or somebody, you simply, as I say, pull the pocket or leave the drug, and case is closed. Apparent, and particularly if they had a history of drugs. And this went off quickly with Lenny Bruce, who was very political, who was complaining about the system, the murder of John Kennedy, and so forth, who said a few dirty words that are common knowledge, and I can even put them on the air. And he may have had a drug habit, he did. But you give him a nice little overdose, and you say, well, you know Bruce had a drug problem. You get rid of him, and then you don't have that kind of a nightclub act anymore. Well, there is a call for opening up this case, and I say this didn't make the headlines. You didn't see much about that. Another story you might or might not have seen, Western Public Relations Chief for 20th Century Fox, beaten to death. He was bludgeoned to death, a longtime organizer for distributing movies, Lee Allen Beaupre, B-E-A-U-P-R-E, 42 years old, found in Los Angeles. He's been working 6 months for 20th Century Fox. He was a reporter for the Variety, for Daily Variety in Hollywood. He distributed Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, The Exorcist, The Apocalypse Now, The Trial of Billy Jack, lived in Westwood just 6 months with 20th Century Fox. Now, you know, Chris Graff owns 20% of 20th Century Fox, and John DeLorean was on the board of Chris Graff. There are a lot of investigations of 20th Century Fox with the Continental Bank in Illinois. Now they've been going on. 20th Century Fox is a dangerous group to work for. They all seem to be, but there are a lot of deaths around that studio that I do want to do. I've accumulated them since the time that John DeLorean was arrested, and They changed hands over there and new managers came in. There had been a whole series of deaths at 20th Century Fox. There's no motive, no reason. He was bludgeoned to death. And because 20th Century is in the news with the DeLorean relationship and Henry Kissinger on the board of 20th Century and Mark Rich is in the news all the time, paying those huge fees for his taxes that he won't pay in the United States. And he bought 50% of 20th Century Fox when Marvin Davis first went in. People around 20th Century Fox are controversial, so I thought I'd mention that. I also forgot to mention this last month, or didn't get into it, former Representative Walter Flowers, a Democrat from Alabama. Richard Nixon mentioned him when Nixon surfaced with his $55,000 to do his TV shows. I think the name of Flowers came up. Flowers, in the House Judiciary, voted two articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And the very week that Richard Nixon is being resurrected in the news media and becoming the darling of the media, Mr. Flowers dropped dead of that very contagious disease called an apparent heart attack. Part of a plane falls off and a apparent heart attack. Well, he had an apparent heart attack, political enemy from the House Judiciary against Nixon. As Nixon's star rises, people around him, and certainly lots of Watergate-related deaths that I wrote about and talk about, coincidence or not, the same week that Nixon is surfacing and the darling of the media, he dropped dead, 51 years old. Congressman Hurt fleeing house fire. This one didn't die, but he broke his back. Representative James Sessenbrenner from Wisconsin has a broken back. He was on the second floor of his house, and the house burned down, about $150,000 worth of damage. Three-term congressman from Milwaukee. He's on the House Judiciary Subcommittee, like Flower was on the House Judiciary. At the house at the time were two students from Australia. I wonder if there were Nugent hand connections. The wife and children were conveniently away. They were flying to Milwaukee, where they spend the summer. He's alone with two people from Australia. Two of them run away. He's asleep when the fire's going. Then the house guests, they're very nice house guests, they run out. And he's left, Mr. Sessenbrenner, and jumped out the window and broke his back, and I haven't heard much about it since then. This was just this last week. I looked up in Who's Who and in the congressional bio about Sessenbrenner because when I talk about Senator Joe McCarthy and the people behind him from Wisconsin, there was a Frank Sussenbrenner, the same spelling, and Walter Harnischfeger that I've talked about, the two Nazi connections to Senator Joe McCarthy. And I have no way of knowing that the same city and the same name and spelling in the congressional directory didn't give that much background. This particular Sussenbrenner went to Stanford University, and it gives his political life and who he married, but very little in the congressional directory. It'd be interesting to know if he's related to the same Sussenbrenner that put Senator Joe McCarthy in, and what was going on at the house with the people from Australia. You know, the Nugenhan story is far from over. It's just boiling to the edge, along with that bank in Hawaii, the CIA bank, and the various murders. And I mentioned last week or the week before the fellow arrested in San Francisco linked to the Nugenhan bank and William Colby, who said he would be killed if he was sent back, that so many people were killed. Well, that is like St. Helena, you know, the volcano. This thing is boiling over. So if I see that there's house guests from Australia and they leave the house and he's left to jump and the house is burning, I have to ask why, or at least call your attention to it. Now, down in Florida, there were articles and law opinions on David Kennedy's death, and we've talked about those. One in the Los Angeles Herald: judge okays the police refusal to supply the Kennedy data, a criminal investigation underway, and there was a big argument about releasing the autopsy report of David Kennedy, and finally there was a very strict mean court order saying you've got to release it, and then when they released it, they described groin injections in the Kennedy autopsy, and the gentleman down in Dade County who released this, Dr. Charles Weldy, said that's pretty unusual. The most people don't go to the kind of trouble, except people that are military or public figures or high profile. The military inject themselves in the groin with cocaine, or public figures. I thought public figures sniffed it, but I can't imagine the kicks you get in the groin out of this, but one thing I thought of when I read it, and I talked with people who said, well, it's not uncommon. It may be uncomfortable, but not uncommon. Why did they hold this back for 2 to 3 weeks, the autopsy report, if it's so common? And I remember Gregory saying that when he was down in Atlanta checking on the children who had been murdered, that many of them had needle marks in the groin. Now, those little kiddies weren't taking cocaine in the groin. And he thought it was to experiment on interferon or some other kind of thing that they were doing. He thought it was extracting interferon with them for cancer research. And he thought it was unusual that the autopsy showed needle marks in the groin. So if it's common, if you say to me it's common for people of the newspapers, of the military, or the in social life to take it, then why would these little children or teenagers down in Atlanta that were murdered have these needle marks? And so the question of David Kennedy, they also said on the autopsy report that they didn't find any arm, no needle marks were visible in his arms, or any incision revealed scar tissue, so that wasn't forced to go to the groin, and he could sniff it through his nose, and he'd been in a rehab place for a month up in Minneapolis, and they didn't find any other area but in the groin. Now, the New York Daily News has a story about David Kennedy, and a woman whose picture was found at the hotel room, otherwise it wouldn't have made the news in this particular paper, and it's been kept out of most of them. And it says, one piece of the puzzle still missing is prior to his death, the people he's with. A blonde German-born model in her late 30s was reported to have told the police and friends she was having dinner with David Kennedy in Palm Beach that evening. Kennedy wasn't interested in making any passes at her. She was more like a sister, she said, and so she went back to his place and accompanied to his room. His sister, you know, okay, no newcomer at the social amenities and so forth, but just on a platonic relationship, she went to the room. And the article says that's where the dark side of Kennedy's life took over, when he produced this cocaine. And police said that they found this woman because left in the room was a small portfolio with her photograph and her name that happened to be in Kennedy's room. And they got in touch with her, and she was frightened to death. And she said, I'm going back to Germany. Keep in mind, she wasn't interviewed by anybody. It's sort of like with Miss Smith and with John Belushi, only she's known to the people in town. This German woman said, I'm leaving. I'm afraid of my life. I'm going back to Germany. But I was with him that night. Maybe she put the needle in his groin. They happened to get her, but her name isn't in the major news or wire services. But who is the woman from Germany who had dinner with him, who went back to the room, who left afterwards, who just by a fluke left the name? The New York Daily News carried the story, and they said that there was still mystery to this. So if there were no other injections on him and they held back the report, what were they holding back? Now, along with our Memorial Weekend, which is winding up, we can still talk about some more deaths. Mr. Michael Sindona is sitting in a bank in a jail in New York. He's ready, serving his time for the breaking up of the Franklin National Bank. Sindona wants to go back to Italy. He wants to be tried for the killing of George Ambrosoli, AMBROSOLI, who was liquidating Sindona's bank. And he wants to go back there to be tried. Well, what he wants to do is to leave Italy like Licio Gelli and go down to Argentina. So he's asking for them to extradite him so he won't have to sit in this cruddy American jail for X amount of years. So he says, send me back to the murder trial. I'll go back. And I'm sure that trial would be a farce. So he's trying to be extradited. He asked at his trial to have the CIA speak, that he worked with the CIA, and I'm sure the CIA would love to get him out of the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan, where he masterminded the end of the Franklin National Bank, and get him back there and let him be charged. Remember, Mr. Errico, the hitman that he was supposed to have hired, was killed out of the same jail in New York City, trying to escape out of the ninth floor just a little while ago. So as long as the witness is dead, Sindona says, oh, send me back now, and let's talk about that murder. And then once he's out of this country, he's home free. He can break the banks, and he also can be home free. And incidentally, speaking of Michael Sindona, there is a newsletter out. Somebody sent me a copy, and some of you may not be aware of it. Certainly I wasn't. It's called Church and State, and it's more interesting and factual than, say, the atheist group. Okay, it's, let me give you the address. It's a magazine, Church and State, published every month. It comes out by the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It's $10 a year, a dollar for a single copy. It comes out of Silver Springs, Maryland. You can write 8120 Fenton Street, Silver Springs, Maryland, 20910. Send a self-addressed label stamp if you want some information. It's $10 a year. And they have a picture of Ronald Reagan touching the finger of John Paul II, like E.T., called The Vatican Connection. And it has a roundup in the Capitol, Reagan's work with church and state, going into the parochial schools, the tax credits, and state legislature, and a large article in this particular issue that was sent to me on this February 1984 on the Vatican connection with Ronald Reagan, and a detailed work on his close link to the Vatican and campus crusades of missionaries in the schools, and an article, God and Man at the CIA, recruiting religion and combining the religion and the Bible with the Central Intelligence Agency. And then it says, no church has been used and abused more than the Roman Catholic Church, how the CIA has used them. And the whole issue is on the various organizations should be separated from government. It's a very interesting magazine. I appreciate the person who sent it to me, and I am going to subscribe to it. It doesn't mean you don't have to believe in God. You don't throw God out. What it means is that you keep that out of the government and don't use the funds of the Vatican, like Michael Sindona or Alessio Gelli, to buy your president. You don't have $1 million to put up to for this election. The way they have, you may send 10 or 20 or 1,000, but the Vatican gives them millions. And so you have a right to understand the process, get everything you can in the way of literature to see what the new bills are, what the legislation is, who the congressmen are, like Senator Lugar, who's the chief fundraiser for the GIOP, being close to the Vatican and Nazis in Europe and getting funds from them. Why do you think our congressmen and our presidents act like Nazis in these various countries? Because they're paid by Nazis to do what they're doing. And if you want to separate people like Senator D'Amato from New York, or Senator Lugar from Indiana, and their close ties to Vatican, or the various Mormon ties that are close to the intelligence community, keep the church out of the electoral process if you can. It's never been more prominent than it is now. And speaking of churches, on CBS this week, just last Sunday morning, I was so impressed with a program put out by a group in San Jose, a private school called the Bellarmine Community School, run by Jesuits, a Catholic school. And they had a three-day seminar, and they worked on it for months, and then they closed the school for 3 weeks and discussed nothing but peace, the search for peace. And they had two members of Congress, Don Edwards and Congressman Chow, from one a Republican and one a Democrat, talking about bombs and peace, and they read the pastoral letter of the Vatican. What did it mean to them? How do you interpret it? How do you live in a world that is spending $800 million a day on nuclear arms? $800 million a day. That's a good place to wind up the Memorial Day broadcast. $800 million a day. And they had the most brilliant young students, and they're sending them out in the world, and they talked about the morality of this, and they said, if you want to fight communism, there is no precedent in what Jesus did that he would meet anybody, even if he thought they were an enemy, in that way. If you don't meet them in peace, don't meet them at all. Don't meet them in fear. Meet them head on. And a lot of people think, because I talk about the Vatican and the CIA, that I'm anti-religious or talk about the Zionists and the Nazis. I'm not. You can keep your religion and get your spies out of religion. But if you're celebrating Memorial Day, and that's what this day is set aside for, how can you have a Memorial Day to those who died and allow your government to spend $800 million a day on weapons? You better do some soul-searching That's what these young people did, and maybe next year on Memorial Day, we'll put brakes on this and do something about it if we can. This is Mae Brussel. My time is up now. I'll be back with you next week. It's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California.